Jesus calls his disciples and those who are following him. He calls them around and he says, anyone who wants to be my disciple must pick up their cross and follow me. If you seek to gain your life, you will lose it. But if you are willing to lose your life for my name, you will gain. For what does it profit a man or a woman to gain the whole wide world, yet lose their soul? This morning, I want to speak for a couple of moments from the title, Striving to Lose. Striving to Lose. About a decade ago, I can recall sitting around my parents' dinner table, having a conversation about the coming of Lent. We never discussed such things in my house when I was a child. We were churchgoers, but as sliding Baptist, Methodist, evangelicals, we didn't pay too much attention to the liturgical calendar. The seasons of Advent, Epiphany, Pentecost, and Lent, those were the things for the Catholics, we thought. Rather, we were CMEs, not Christian Methodist Episcopal, but we paid attention to Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter. Yet this year, somehow, in some way, Lent made it onto our radars. As we went around the table and boasted about the things that we were giving up, we went one by one. My father went first, and I can recall him saying that he was giving up fried foods. The doctor was riding him about his weight at the time, so he saw Lent as an opportune time to get his diet on track. Yours truly declared that I was renouncing my then growing addiction to my new handheld email device known as the BlackBerry, what my wife quickly came to refer to as a crackberry. Who knew that at that time that the now primitive track wheel was but a gateway drug to the future touchscreen of the iPhone? Then we came around to my mother. And with an unapologetic, if not iconoclastic tone, my mother declared, at my age, I reckon that I can give up trying to give up stuff. And as we gather here this morning, the second weekend of Lent, I want to consider my mother's sentiment as a sermonic springboard. For in hindsight, I now wonder if she offered us an appropriate proposition to consider. Sometimes satirical quips can contain profound wisdom. Well, Lent, what is Lent? What is Lent anyway? The term came to use in the late Middle Ages, described these 40 days before Easter. Like the German Lons, the term meaning springtime or even lengthening of days. But when we place appropriate emphasis on the 40-day period, the 40-day period of Jesus' progression toward death row and subsequent resurrection, we know that Lent is not just a season. But Lent is also a process. Lent is a progression from one stage to another stage, from one season to another season. Lent signifies liminality. It signifies the betwixt and the between of life. And I would contend that living here in New England, it's easy to envision Lent as that in-between season. For Lent begins right when most of us are getting fed up with the cruel, chilly winds of winter, and we're anticipating the warm zephyrs of early spring. But Lent is also about the actual lengthening process. Not just the lengthening of days of the season, but rather the individual acts of faith which constitute transition. Such acts might include quiet contemplative moments of penitence. Or they may include gracious acts of goodwill that might bring us closer to God and closer to our neighbors. Helping dig out the neighbor's car from the snow. Demonstrating penitence on the subway or train by demonstrating greater levels of patience during this time of year. Or even purchasing a sleeping bag or meal for our community members who sleep outdoors. I guess the question that I want to pose this morning and I want us all to consider is, how might you and I become more cognizant of the minor things that have major significance? The minor things that God can lengthen to have an incredible, indelible impact. Might it be a warm smile to the woman on the corner toward fighting or lengthening our resolve to fight homelessness? Could it be an awareness of our sustainable practices toward lengthening our commitment to becoming a better steward of the planet? It might even be, in the words of Alice Walker, noticing the color purple in the field as an act of admiration and wonder of Almighty God. I guess this quest is what compels the poet Mary Oliver to wake early as she greets the grace and goodness that compels her to be aware of the world. "Hello, sun in my face," she writes. "Hello, you who make the morning and spread it over into the fields. You, I face the faces of the tulips, and in the nodding morning glories, and into the windows of even the miserable and the crotchery. It's the best preacher that ever was. Watch now how I start the day. How I start the day in happiness and in kindness." And it's in recognizing the minute miracles and the mundane wonders of life where we might lengthen our commitment to contributing toward a better world. We create a better world, my friends, by becoming better people. Not people who are solipsistic, narcissistic, and thus self-protective and pessimistic. No, but rather people who know how to let go of themselves so that they might embrace someone else. People who don't ask, "What will happen to me if I concern myself with you?" But rather people who will ask, "What will happen to me if I do not concern myself with you?" In many ways, I think such questions can inform how we might interpret Jesus' moral challenge and questions to his disciples. We read that Jesus called them all together, his followers, and he says, "If anyone wants to be my disciple, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me." Now, there's no denying the soteriological implications of this text. All today's verses form the basis of a theological argument central to the Christian faith. Salvation is a result of the atoning work of Christ, the Messiah that gave his life on a cross, God then raised into everlasting life. And if we follow this Messiah, as stated in John 3:16, anyone who believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. But I want to suggest this morning that Jesus is also providing a moral and ethical framework for living here. A moral and ethical framework that extends well beyond theological debates about Christian salvation. A moral and ethical framework that has the positive and practical benefit for the Christian, the Jew, the Muslim, the Buddhist, the agnostic, the atheist. What's Jesus talking about when he says, "Follow me"? Might it be a call to interact with the world in the way that he did? Might it be a call to invert the social order insofar as our attentiveness to serve is not directed upward toward those in power, but downward toward those who are powerless? A call to live our lives in the cares and concerns of the most vulnerable, like Jesus did, in order for us to then find our true purpose and meaning in them. Now, I can already feel somebody here saying to themselves, or even rolling your eyes to yourself, "This is just another Pollyannish impractical sermon full of feel-good platitudes. Hurry up, Rev. Go ahead and say it and get it over with. Feed the poor, clothe the naked, help the homeless, so I can hurry up and go enjoy Sunday brunch and my glass of fine wine." Believe me, I get it. In fact, this week in my Evangelicals and Politics course, we read Reinhold Niebuhr's 1944 book, The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness. I better make sure I get this right, because the professor that taught me Niebuhr is sitting here this morning, Peter Paris. But in this book, Children of Light, Children of Darkness, Niebuhr calls religious children of light plain stupid for not realizing how ego, pride, and the human inclination or will to power short circuits our capacity to do good for others. We don't get that. We just have feel-good platitudes, but we don't realize how pride and ego drive human interactions. Anxiety born of fear and frustration will always lead people back to the questions, "What about me? What about my life? What about my people? What about my kind? What about my group?" But it seems, my friends, that Jesus understood something in the ancient world that scientists have come to verify in recent years. Anxiety only begets more anxiety. Worrying about oneself only makes one more nervous, yet doing good deeds, being positive toward others, and serving those in need actually makes anxious and depressed people feel better about themselves. Oh, for instance, you can check out the findings of Stephen Post of Case Western Reserve School of Medicine. Oh, in his wonderful book, When Good Things Happen to Good People. The book includes a 50-year study of people who began serving and assisting others in high school, and he compared those to the lives of people who lived primarily for themselves, ego-driven. The people who gave of themselves experienced better physical and mental health throughout their lives. In addition, helping others brought positive health benefits to those people who are suffering from chronic illnesses. If you're suffering from a chronic illness and you get out and you begin to serve others, it actually helps your life. People dealing with chronic illnesses such as HIV, multiple sclerosis, and heart disease. Those who lose their lives, I hear Jesus saying, will find it. You compare this to the studies of those who live insulated, self-protective lives. This leads to chronic loneliness, and even when surrounded by so-called friends and family, this chronic loneliness has negative health benefits. Chronic loneliness causes the stress hormone cortisol to increase, which leads to unhealthy weight gain and also to the risk for dementia and premature death. Those who seek to save or protect their lives, I hear Jesus saying, will lose it. But come on. We don't need Stephen Post. We don't need modern medicine or research to prove these points. Myths regarding the danger of self-love can be traced back to antiquity. Oh, some of you may recall in Greek mythology, the son of the river god Cephisus, a self-obsessed character by the name of Narcissus. Narcissus was known and appreciated by all for his amazing beauty. Everyone wanted to be near him. People attempted to love him, but he treated others with disdain, believing that all others were unworthy of his incredible gift. That's why Nemesis, the divine angel of retribution for arrogance against the gods, showed up at Narcissus' door. Nemesis led Narcissus to a pool where he saw his own reflection and fell in love. But unable to let go of his own reflection, Narcissus ultimately drowned. Those who seek to gain their lives, I hear Jesus saying, will ultimately lose it. So I guess this is what I'm trying to sum up for us this morning. This is what I'm thinking about during this amazing season of Lent. Let us not become so fixated on ourselves during this season of denial. Let us not be so concerned with bragging and boasting about, I'm giving up on this, I'm giving up on that. I'm striving to lose 10 pounds during Lent before spring arrives. Rather than a season of preparation and penitence, Lent for some of us has become a season of narcissism and egoism. This is why my mother may have been on to something with her declaration that she was giving up on stuff. Maybe rather than focus on what we're giving up, maybe we can focus on giving to others. In what ways might you and I strive to lose ourselves in the cause of somebody else? And I just imagine, my friends, that when we do this, we might be able to then come into this space of worship on Sunday morning and sing with the great 18th century hymn writer William Cowper, God gives his mercies to be spent. Your hoard will do your soul no good. Gold is a blessing only lent, repaid by giving others food. What does it profit us to gain the whole wide world, but lose our soul?